laws that govern our interactions with the world are stable and immutable. We expect water to be wet and fire to be hot, gravity to make things fall. Our expectations form the basis of our perception of the world. They provide a sense of stability and predictability. If we had no expectations at all, living would become nearly impossible. Things get more slippery when we talk about expectations regarding other people. People are self-determining with their own motivations and priorities. We can expect some things of other people. We expect that our friends won't set fire to the house or steal the cat when they come to visit. But our expectations are always going to be hampered by the fact that we can't really tell what's happening inside another person's head. Sometimes people do set fire to the house or steal cats. Let's talk about reasonable and unreasonable expectations. The difference is subjective. There's a lot of fuzzy grey overlap. Some expectations are clearly reasonable. We expect our friends not to punch us in the nose without provocation. We expect our romantic partners not to drain our bank account and run off to Cancun with the grocer. Other expectations are just as clearly unreasonable. We would not expect a new date who's just turned up in fancy formal dress to be enthusiastic if we say, "You need to go and clean the cat box for me." Between the two clear extremes lie the waters where reefs lurk, ready to shipwreck the unwary. Our expectations can run aground at just about any point in a relationship. We do not, by and large, have the right to expect things of people without their consent. We cannot be angry at someone for failing to do something she did not agree to do in the first place. The skill of expectation management means more than trying to navigate between reasonable and unreasonable expectation. It means recognizing that a desire on my part does not constitute an obligation on your part, and we can never reasonably be upset for someone for failing to live up to our expectations if we haven't talked about our expectations in the first place. Questions to ask yourself. When you're thinking about what you want from your relationship life and how you'd like your relationships to be structured, here are some questions it might be useful to ask yourself and talk over with your partner or partners if you're in a relationship. Why do I have relationships with other people? What needs do I have from my partners in terms of time, emotional availability, commitment, communication, and intimacy? What does commitment mean to me, and why? When I think about the future, what does it look like? Is there room for change and growth? How much do I value personal autonomy, transparency, cohabitation, having and raising children, shared finances, community, tradition, the opinions of my friends and family, adhering to social norms? What values are most important to me in myself and in others? Are the choices I make in alignment with these values? Who are my mirrors? Whom do I rely on to call me on my mistakes? How do I respond to criticism from people close to me? How do I evaluate my choices when the effects of my actions are impossible to predict? What do I expect of others and why? 6. Communication pitfalls. All words have not a single meaning, but a swarm of them, like bees around a hive. Maureen O'Brien. If you've heard anything about polyamory, you've likely heard this. The first rule of polyamory is communicate, communicate, communicate. But what does that mean exactly? Communication is trickier than it sounds. It covers a lot more than saying what's on your mind. And even saying what's on your mind can be surprisingly tough. Then there's the listening part. There are 1,000 ways communication can fail, and only a few ways for it to succeed. Yet, good communication is a process, and it's essential to building trust, demonstrating respect, and understanding the needs of people you're close to. When we talk about communication in polyamory, we're usually talking about a very specific type of communication. Speaking the truth about ourselves, our needs, and our boundaries with honesty and precision, and listening with grace when our partners speak of themselves, their needs, and their boundaries. This kind of communication isn't really about words. It's about vulnerability, self-knowledge, integrity, empathy, compassion, and a whole lot of other things. Communication is such a complex subject that we've divided it into two chapters. This chapter addresses ways communication can run off a cliff, including being imprecise, dishonest, passive, and coercive. The next chapter discusses strategies to help you succeed. Fuzzy language. In poly circles, people often complain that conversations about poly always seem to come back to semantics. This is actually a good thing. The poly community tends to focus on communication, and communication relies on words having shared meanings. Arriving at that mutual understanding is what semantics is all about. On one hand, language is a marvelously flexible and resilient tool. If you read a sentence containing non-English futzpas, even if you've never heard of futzpas before, you can often glock their meaning from context. On the other hand, the simplest way for communication to go wrong is when one person uses a familiar word in a way that another person misinterprets. For example, Franklin once had a conversation with Celeste that went something like this. Celeste, can you do me a favour and pass the sweeper? Franklin, what's a sweeper? Celeste, the thing that vacuums the rug, you know, the vacuum cleaner. Franklin, oh, right, okay, here you go. Celeste, you never help me around the house. You expect me to do everything. I ask you to do one thing and you won't do it. Franklin, wait, you asked me to pass the sweeper and I gave you the vacuum cleaner. It's what you wanted, right? Celeste, no, I asked you to vacuum for me. Pass the sweeper means pass it over the rug. Small words can hide big misunderstandings. What is sex? What is a relationship? What do we mean by words such as permission, consent, or commitment? A disagreement about the meaning of that last word popped up during a panel on polyamory Franklin once participated in at a convention. Audience member, it's obvious that people with multiple romantic relationships can't be committed because commitment means you're dedicated to only one person. Someone who is not committed can't be trusted because they have no commitment to you. Franklin, but what if someone is committed to more than one person? Audience member, impossible. That's a logical contradiction. Commitment means dedication to only one person. You can't be dedicated to two people any more than you can divide a circle into three halves. A person who has more than one partner has no commitment and therefore can't be trusted. What's obvious to one person may not be obvious to another, and we discuss this in Chapter 19 on sex. Even defining the word sex can create a thorny tangle. Slippery words. When the two of us communicate about relationships, we try to steer clear of certain words. Some words come preloaded with expectations and emotional baggage, which makes them prone to misuse. These words easily become tools of manipulation because they sound reasonable on the surface, but have meanings that are difficult to pin down. Respect. Many people are fond of saying things like, new partners must respect my existing relationships, and it sounds reasonable after all. Who would go into a relationship saying, I plan to disrespect all the other folks involved? But what does it mean to respect a relationship? Does it mean to yield to the people in that relationship all the time? Does it mean to always do what they say? Respect is reciprocal. What respect are the people in the relationship prepared to offer a new relationship? Rather than use vague words like respect, you will benefit from spelling out what your expectations are. If you believe that older relationships have priority in terms of time and scheduling, for example, say so. Using vague words like respect creates an easy way to accuse others of breaking agreements any time they do something you don't like, without actually having to make explicit agreements. Come first. Another agreeable-sounding but vague phrase we've heard often is, my existing obligations come first. Nobody enters a relationship with a clean slate. We all have previous commitments that require tending, perhaps to children, a sick relative, a demanding job or a business association. This is true in monogamous relationship as well as polyamorous ones. So if we say existing obligations come first, does it simply mean we have outstanding responsibilities we intend to discharge? That's reasonable in any sort of relationship. Or is it a way of saying, I will look after your needs only if they aren't inconvenient to the other people in my life? As all too often seems to be true. Does it mean that an existing partner may always usurp time allocated to a new partner? Better to spell out what existing commitments you have and what you need to do to discharge them, rather than to simply say, come first. fair and equal. These words can conjure up images of relationships where everyone is doled out the same size slice of pumpkin pie, even if some folks are hungrier than the others and some are allergic to pumpkins. Equality of opportunity is a very different thing than equality of circumstance. If people want different things, then it makes sense that their circumstances will be different. What's most fair is not necessarily an even division of resources, but rather a distribution that meets as many of the needs of all of the people as possible. Rights. In Chapter 3, we've talked about the high bar something must reach to be called a right. Few things rise to that level, so right is a word that should be used very cautiously. Some things you do not have a right to expect in any relationship. To never be challenged. To always be comfortable. To always have other people navigate around your triggers and discomforts. Things you do not have a right to do include to treat people as expendable, to extract promises that someone will never leave you, and to control other people's relationships. All these things require negotiation. Relationships are always voluntary. You have the right to end a relationship that does not meet your needs, and so does your partner. But you do not have the right to demand that your partner do what you want. Success. When you think of successful relationships, what comes to mind? Relationships that last a certain amount of time? Relationships that have no disagreement? It can be tempting to call a relationship successful if it lasts. But what if the members of that relationship treat their other partners poorly? Success should apply to everyone involved, not just some of them. If a polycouple stays together for a long time, but they treat their other partners poorly or hurt a lot of other people in the process, we would not necessarily consider their relationship a success. When you use the word success, are you only thinking about a particular relationship or about all of them? Reasonable. The word reasonable and its evil twin, unreasonable, get tossed around very easily. Is it reasonable to want to tell a partner what position she is allowed to have sex in? Is it reasonable for a partner to kiss someone else in front of you? The problem is, what's reasonable is largely cultural and subjective. Most people would probably say it's not reasonable to have multiple lovers in the first place. Polyamory is still new enough that we have not yet established cultural norms of reasonableness. So instead of talking about what's reasonable, talk about the specifics of how something makes you feel. How do you react when you see your partner kiss someone else in front of you? Why? How can you negotiate with your partner about ways to do things differently? Talk about what you need and how your partner can help you, and negotiate a solution that works for everyone. Healthy. This is an especially dangerous word. Some relationships are genuinely healthy and others are unhealthy. But all too often, this word is used to judge behaviors we simply don't like. A relationship that violates your consent is, indeed, unhealthy. A relationship in which you are threatened with violence is unhealthy. A codependent or enabling relationship is unhealthy. But your partner doing something you don't like is not necessarily unhealthy. Sometimes healthy relationships are uncomfortable. Instead of using the word healthy, we recommend talking directly about behaviors that trouble you and why they do. If you sincerely believe your partner's behavior is unhealthy, it might be time to seek professional help with your partner, if possible, and for yourself if your partner won't participate. Dishonesty. Honesty is one of the defining factors that separate polyamorous relationships from cheating. It's also, not surprisingly, one of the defining elements of good communication. However, it can be harder than it sounds. Even though we all probably agree that honesty is important in a relationship, it's surprising how often we will still choose not to be honest. Otherwise, well-intentioned people who generally act in good faith can end up making that choice for any number of reasons. The most common reason is emotional vulnerability, fear of rejection, fear of being ridiculed, fear of being wrong, of hearing no, of being found less desirable by our partners. And even as we claim to want honesty, we may subtly discourage our partners from being honest with us because we don't feel prepared to hear truths that might be painful. People who are dishonest with their partners, especially when they are dishonest not by lying but by concealing things or not saying what's on their minds, often seek to control information as a way to control their partner's behavior. Another reason people can be dishonest is they fear upsetting or offending their partners, especially about sex. If you don't enjoy what your partner does, you may say nothing to avoid making him feel bad. This tends to backfire in long-term relationships because someone who doesn't know that his partner is unsatisfied will never improve, and an unsatisfying relationship is always under stress. Problem is, one of the most basic rules of life is that you cannot get what you want if you don't ask for what you want. Franklin runs a website of educational resources about BDSM, activities related to dominance and submission, or sadomasochism. Many years ago, a person read his site and wrote to say he'd always wanted to explore BDSM, but had never had. He'd been married for 10 years, but had never talked to his wife about it, because he was afraid of how she might react. He asked Franklin, "What do you think I should do?" Naturally, Franklin said, "Talk to her. Tell her, this is something I'm interested in. What do you think?" About a week later, Franklin received a reply. The guy finally worked up the courage to talk to his wife about exploring BDSM. He discovered that years before they'd met, she'd been involved in a BDSM relationship and enjoyed it quite a lot. But she had never talked to him about it because she was afraid of how he would react. Such failures to communicate happen when we lead with our fears instead of our hopes. If we spend too much time thinking about what can go wrong, we forget what can go right. Life is better when you lead with your hopes, not your fears. Perhaps the most common justification for dishonesty in a relationship is the notion that the truth will hurt worse than a lie. A person who cheats on a partner may think, "If I tell the truth, I will hurt my partner. But if I don't, my partner won't need to experience that pain." This reasoning says more about the person making the argument than it does about the person he is protecting, because consent is not valid if not informed. By hiding the truth, we deny our partners the opportunity to consent to continuing a relationship with us. Controlling information to try and keep a partner, or to get a partner to do what we want, is one way we treat people as things. And remember, honesty begins inside. A person who is dishonest with himself cannot be honest with anyone else. People are dishonest with themselves for many reasons, including having ideas about what they should be. If they think desiring multiple partners is dishonorable, they may convince themselves that they don't even if they do. Likewise, if someone wants only one partner, she may convince herself otherwise because she believes polyamory is more enlightened. We can lie to ourselves for more subtle reasons as well. A woman whose husband is threatened by the idea of her having another male lover might tell herself, "Well, it's okay. I really don't want to be with another man," even if, in some corner of her mind, she would. Passive communication. Passive communication refers to communicating through subtext, avoiding direct statements, and looking for hidden meanings. Passive communicators may use techniques such as asking questions or making vague, indirect statements in place of stating needs, preferences, or boundaries. Directly asking for what you want creates vulnerability, and passive communication often comes from a desire to avoid this vulnerability. Passive communication also offers plausible deniability. If we state a desire for something indirectly and we don't get it, it's easy to claim that we didn't really want it. Stating our needs means standing up for them and taking the risk that others may not agree to meet them. One way this happens is by couching desires as questions. "Would you like to go out for Thai food tonight?" Or worse, "Don't you think it's been a long time since we went out for dinner?" To a passive communicator, such a statement can be a coded way to say, "I would like to go out for Thai food tonight." The problem is, a direct communicator might naturally hear only what was said and give a direct answer. "No, I don't really feel like going out tonight." This can leave the passive communicator feeling disregarded. She might end up thinking, "He never pays attention to my needs." When to the direct communicator, no request was stated. He was asked how he felt. The direct communicator might end up thinking, "She never asks for what she wants. She expects me to read her mind. If she wanted to go out, she could have said so." When we're talking about dinner, indirect communication might not matter too much. When we're talking about things that are more complicated, like emotional boundaries or relationship expectations, indirect communication can lead to a crisis of misunderstanding. Here is Eve's story.
My relationship with Kira lasted only a few months, but the damage it left was lasting. By the time it ended, I felt profoundly unseen, unheard, and unknown by someone I had only recently imagined I had a deep intimacy with. I felt not like a person, but like an actor who had been cast for a role. As though everything, the flirtation, the relationship, the breakup, was scripted in advance by Kira's expectations and beliefs. And I felt I had little influence over this trajectory because Kira and I couldn't communicate. Kira was raised in a family that communicated passively, and she spent her adolescence in a culture where passive communication was the norm. The irony was that she valued and often talked about assertive communication, but her habits were too deeply ingrained for her to recognize them, let alone unlearn them. I learned quickly the disorienting, frustrating, and often maddening consequences of being in love with someone for whom every statement had a double meaning. To Kira, what mattered was not what I said, but what she imagined I had said, and that appeared to come from scripts deep in her psyche. Kira would imagine I wanted things I'd never asked for, give them to me as though they were her idea, and then blame me when she was unhappy about having given them. Her ideas that I wanted them came from cryptic readings of things I had said or done, and it did no good for me to deny I had wanted or asked for them. To her, I had asked, passively. I was not permitted to deny the reality of the hidden meanings that Kira believed in, but I had never meant. Kira would forward me messages she had received from others or ask me to view online conversations she was participating in, expecting me to be deeply offended or outraged by what I read. When I could not find the events of statements, she would explain to me at length the hidden meaning of the conversation, what was really happening behind the words that were being said. She could create a detailed story from very few words. Our relationship ended with her telling me such a story. I listened in disbelief and no small anguish as she told me what I had wanted, what I believed, what I expected, all of which had been read into my words or actions, and none of which was true. And the hardest part was that I couldn't counter any of it. Passive communication was so second nature to Kira that it simply wasn't possible for her to believe that my words had meant exactly what I said they did, that not everything had a hidden meaning. To Kira, what she imagined lay behind my words was more important than my words, and that ended the possibility of communication between us.
Passive communication is the norm in many families, and indeed many cultures. Every now and then, some pop psych article will surface that compares passive with direct communication and says neither is inherently better, and all you need to do is learn which style someone is using and adapt to it. In polyamorous relationships, though, passive communication will fuck you right up, and your partners, and their partners. It's true that some cultures, the Middle Eastern culture that Kira grew up in, for example, do use very subtle, nuanced passive communication, and there's nothing wrong with that in its own cultural context. However, in cultures where passive communication is the norm, the paratexts, the subtle verbal and nonverbal cues that tell you the hidden meaning, are shared and understood. We wrote this book for readers in the Western context, where it's almost certain that you, your partners and their partners, will have grown up with different family and cultural backgrounds, and thus different assumptions about what subtle cues convey, what unspoken meanings. Looking for hidden meanings in such a situation leads to a very high chance that you'll be quite simply wrong. When passive communication includes implied threats or demands, it can tip over into manipulation. This can happen in many ways, concealing our real motivations by couching them in pleasant-sounding but leading language, for instance. We wouldn't want anything unpleasant to happen now, would we? Or by waiting for a partner to misinterpret our coded language and then springing something like, "You never listen to me." Here's Eve's story.
I don't remember the exact circumstances under which I shared my Google Calendar with Kira or why. I remember asking her about it first, but she remembers it differently. I do remember that she had never shared a calendar before, and I wanted to show her how it worked. For me, sharing calendars was no big thing. At the time, many of my friends and people I worked with had access to both my personal and work calendars. If I wanted to keep information private, I would make a private event. We didn't discuss boundaries around the calendar or specific expectations about what sharing it meant. As it turned out, she had very different expectations than I did, but I didn't learn that until too late. Because Kira was accustomed to passive communication, she understood my sharing my calendar with her to carry an implicit expectation that she would share hers, although this hadn't occurred to me, and I was quite surprised when she did. After sharing her calendar with me, she felt unacceptably exposed, as though I had full knowledge of her whereabouts at all times, although in fact I only viewed her calendar once during our relationship. Ultimately, the calendar was, to Kira, a symbol of the relationship escalator. Her fears about becoming bound by expectations or commitment became tied to it. The unfortunate part was, we never discussed any of this. She told me only when our relationship was at an end, and any possibility of genuine communication had already been cut off.
A very common problem with passive communication is that people accustomed to it tend to see all communication as passive. They can't switch between passive and direct communication, no matter how direct you are. The passive communicator is certain there's a hidden message, an unstated request or a secret criticism buried somewhere deep in your words. Often, a passive communicator will come up with interpretations that seem plain bizarre, even paranoid. But this just comes from their cultural expectations of how much meaning other people hide in their words. The most effective way we've found for building good communication with a passive communicator is with patience, compassion, and directness. Respond only to the surface words without trying to divine or decode the hidden meaning. If the passive communicator becomes frustrated at your inability to see the actual message, and he will, reiterate that direct communication is the only way you know to make sure the message gets through. Demonstrate clear, direct communication yourself. If your partner misinterprets something you've said or extracts a meaning you didn't intend, be patient and forthright. State your intended meaning plainly. Reassure him that your words carry no hidden intent. Make it clear that you genuinely want to understand. Respond to vague statements with clear, direct questions. Ask for clarification when he says something ambiguous. And above all, keep at it. Don't expect quick change. Passive communication takes a long time to learn, and just as long to unlearn. Storytelling. Humans are storytelling animals. We tell stories to ourselves dozens of times a day, without even being aware of it. We use these stories to make sense of the world and to understand the actions of people around us. Many of these stories relate to other people's motives. We know that people's actions aren't random. We build models in our head that help us understand others. And because we don't come from a factory equipped with magical mind-reading rubies in our foreheads, these models are flawed. They're made up of observation, guesswork, projection, and empathy. Unfortunately, it's natural to react as though our models are perfect. I'm convinced to about 65% accuracy that he's trying to replace me in my lover's affections, but there's considerable room for error. Rather, we say, that bastard is trying to get rid of me. The motives we ascribe to other people's behaviours are coloured by our own fears and insecurities. If we're worried about being supplanted, we tend to read signs in everything. Worse, we are predisposed to view all other people's motives less charitably than our own. Research has shown that we tend to explain our own behaviour in terms of the situation we're in, while we believe the behaviour of others goes directly to their character. When asked why we cut someone else off in traffic, we might say, I was looking the other way and I didn't see him. But when asked why someone else cut us off in traffic, we are more likely to say, she's obviously a reckless driver who doesn't care about anyone else on the road. Sociologists often refer to this as fundamental attribution error. In polyamorous relationships, as you might imagine, this behavior can get pretty ugly. When we tell ourselves stories about other people, we tend to run with those stories rather than what the other people say about the matter. Of course, so-and-so says he isn't trying to separate me from my partner, and that's exactly what he wants me to believe. We propose a radical strategy to deal with what people say. In the absence of concrete evidence to the contrary, believe them. Triangular communication. If we were to set out axioms of good communication, as we try to do in the next chapter, one of them would be that communication about any issue ideally involves the people directly affected. This sounds simple, but it's surprisingly hard to implement. It starts from an early age. Most of us who grew up with siblings can remember at least one time when we said, Mom, Danny's poking me. Or, hey, Dad, Miranda won't stay on her side of the seat. And thus the seed is sown for some of the most tenacious communication problems we will ever face. Triangular communication happens when one person has a problem, concern, or question for another person, but instead of bringing it up directly with that person, instead goes to someone else. It happens when a child has a problem with her brother's behavior and petitions a parent to settle it. It happens online when one person has a problem with somebody else and goes to the faceless masses of the internet to seek validation. It happens when someone at a company has a problem with another person's performance and approaches a co-worker about it. And it happens all the time in polyamorous relationships. Triangular communication can also happen when one person wants to control the flow of information between the partners. Most of us don't like conflict, and controlling the flow of information can seem like a way to avoid or reduce conflict. It can sometimes be a means of minimizing tensions or disagreements. If your partners aren't getting along, you can be tempted to try and interpret one person's words for another. In a way, that shows the message in its most favorable light. It can also happen when you don't trust what your partners might say to each other. In practice, triangular communication leads to diffusion of responsibility. It becomes easy to tell one partner, "I can't do what you want me to do because Susie might not like it," rather than, "I'm choosing not to do what you want me to do because I think Susie might not like it." Veto is arguably an extreme example of this diffusion of responsibility. Eve's story.
Ray and his wife, Danielle, had a hierarchical relationship. Very early on, his wife stressed that I needed to remember she was primary. This was my first polyamorous relationship. I was head over heels for Ray, and Peter and I had assumed we would be using hierarchy as well. So at the time, it seemed entirely reasonable to agree to this. I was naively unaware of what it would actually mean, especially years in. Danielle practiced what a friend of mine called line item veto. Ray and I were in a long-distance relationship, but if I came to visit him, I was expected to alternate nights with her, sometimes at a ratio of two nights hers and one night mine, in the case of a long weekend, for example. If she had plans together and she needed something from him, even if she'd just had a bad day, he had to cancel our plans so he could be with her, even if we weren't going to see each other again for weeks. I tried negotiating directly with Danielle, which got even worse results. For example, I was going to be in town for a weekend, and she proposed that I share a meal with the two of them, as the only time I would see Ray. Over months, my frustration grew. I blamed Danielle for being selfish, inconsiderate, demanding, needy. I was seeing a polyspecialist therapist at the time and was working with her through some of this frustration. She asked me why I was blaming Danielle for Ray's decisions. I didn't have a good answer. I realized then that regardless of his reasons, it was Ray who was canceling dates, Ray who wasn't giving me the time or attention I wanted, Ray who I needed to talk to about what I needed in the relationship, and Ray who could agree whether or not to provide it. This was an epiphany for me, and one that turned around my relationship with Ray. It simply hadn't occurred to me before to see Ray as the co-pilot of our relationship.
Eve's discovery was painful. It's much easier to blame a third party, casting you and your beloved as helpless victims, than to face the fact that your partner is choosing not to invest in your relationship. It can be hard to direct your anger and frustration at the person who is actually hurting you when he's someone you are intimately involved with. And for the pivot person in a V, it's a lot harder to do the gritty work of negotiating solutions among competing needs and deciding how to share your time and resources than it is to stand back and pretend that those solutions are something your partners need to work out between themselves. Metamors are not children, and as a pivot partner, you are not Halloween candy to divide up. Negotiating resource investments in relationships is not like deciding who gets how many Snickers bars and who is stuck with the malted milk balls. Three-way communication is useful to build trust and get a clear understanding of needs and capabilities, but ultimately, the pivot partner is the master of her own decisions and resources. If someone isn't getting what he needs from her, that's something he needs to take up with her, his partner, and she needs to take responsibility. The solution to triangular communication is simple in theory. Don't do it, but difficult in practice. Because it's easier to talk about things that bother us with anyone but the person whose behavior is at issue. And because when we feel wronged, it's natural to seek allies. In practical terms, you can't make other people communicate directly with each other. The best you can do is to limit your own participation in triangular communication. Just back out and tell the people they need to talk to each other. And you should address anything that bothers you directly with the person involved. Try not to be drawn into the role of rescuer when someone comes to you complaining about that terrible thing so-and-so just did. Reserve judgment of the other people in your relationship network and encourage the parties at odds to talk directly to each other rather than through you, without allowing yourself to become a go-between. If you do find yourself stuck in a pattern of triangular communication, it may be useful to pick up Harriet Lerner's Dance of Intimacy, listed in the resources of the digital and paperback versions of this book. To see how triangular communication can go spectacularly wrong, we recommend reading Othello by Shakespeare. When we don't want to communicate. Everything we've talked about so far assumes that the people involved are trying to communicate with each other. We all grasp the value of communication intellectually, but turning that understanding into reality can be really hard, because often we don't actually want to communicate. Communication is scary. We fear open communication when we fear the vulnerability that comes with it. Open communication means exposing yourself to rejection, or judgment, or trouble. It may mean finding out that what you assumed your lover thinks and feels is wrong. It presents the possibility of hearing no to your deepest wishes, and it may mean having your needs or desires turned against you if the relationship is unhealthy. There is no communication, at least not meaningful communication, without vulnerability. Communication can be hard when it leads to embarrassment or shame. If you were brought up to believe that there are certain things, like sex, that you just don't talk about, shame can interfere with communication, and you might end up wondering, why is my sex life so unsatisfying? And being afraid to hear the answer. Another barrier to communication is the notion that there are certain ways people in a relationship should be, so there's no need to talk about it. If he really loves me, of course he will know to do thus and such. Why won't he do thus and such? Everyone knows this is part of a relationship. It must mean he doesn't love me. Yet another of these emotional barriers is the common trap of thinking in generalities and allowing them to take precedence over the specific details of the people in the relationship. As one possible example, everyone knows that men love getting head, so that means I don't need to ask him how he feels about oral sex, because men love getting head. If he tells me he doesn't want me to go down on him, that must mean I'm doing it wrong, and I'm bad at it. If a relationship involves some element of consensual domination and submission, people can fail to communicate because they believe submissives should simply accept whatever the dominant partner wants. Or they may believe submissives shouldn't have a say in their relationship because submissives like to do whatever they're told and never, ever voice their own needs. Some people take this to such an extreme that they even believe submissive partners in dominant, submissive relationships shouldn't have needs of their own. Almost always, communication tends to be most difficult precisely when it's most important. As the relationship coach, Marcia Baczynski, has put it, if you're afraid to say it, it means you need to say it. When we are feeling most raw, most vulnerable, most scared of opening up, those are the times we most need to open up. We can't expect others to respect our boundaries and limits if we don't talk about them, or, worse, pretend they don't exist. It's a bit of a paradox that even as open communication makes us feel vulnerable and exposed, it's essential if we are to protect our boundaries from being violated. We can't expect others to respect our boundaries if we pretend they don't exist. We've been asked whether talking about everything takes some of the mystery out of a relationship. We find that question surprising. We are all, every one of us, complicated and dynamic and always changing, and relationship dynamics are filled with mystery as it is. There's no need to invent more. There is easily enough mystery between two people to fill many lifetimes, even when they're both paying very close attention and are as honest and as transparent with one another as it is possible to be. Relationships based on honesty and transparency, in which the people really pay attention to each other and work to see and understand each other, are more subtle and profoundly complex than relationships that avoid this kind of honesty and knowledge. The more you get to know a person, the more you find that there is to know. And we are all moving targets. We change every day. There'll always be new things to learn, no matter how much we communicate. Coercive communication. Coercion doesn't always involve physical violence or direct threats. It's actually quite easy for relationships to become coercive when the stakes are high, and when we are deeply attached or committed to another person, they are high. Coercion happens any time you make the consequences of saying no so great that you removed reasonable choice. A subtle sort of coercion arises any time you believe that your partner owes you something. For example, if you think your partner owes you intimacy, and you are just expressing your feelings about what you're owed, there is a good chance you're being coercive. If your partner says no, and you start preparing for a fight instead of accepting their choice, you're probably being coercive. If your partner sets a boundary or says no to a request, she probably has a good reason. That reason might not even be about you. It's important to respect a no, even when you don't understand it. Show appreciation for your partner's self-advocacy and self-knowledge. Be grateful for the intimacy she has shown you, and make it clear that you respect her autonomy and ability to make choices, even if you don't understand what's happening or why. We're talking about boundaries your partner sets on herself, which, as we discuss in chapter 9 and 10, are quite different from rules she places on you. It is always appropriate to negotiate things another person places on you, though it sometimes takes careful attention to recognize the difference. It is also possible that in setting boundaries, a partner is being manipulative, using boundary setting as a way to coerce you. Withdrawal and silence, classic techniques of emotional blackmail, can initially be difficult to distinguish from healthy boundary setting. A person could be withdrawing just to punish you, but that doesn't change what you should do. The solution is to never try and force someone to do something they don't want to do. Thank them and respect their choice. If you can't respect their choice, it's time to examine your own boundaries. If you're hurting because of a boundary your partner has set, knowing how to practice active listening can be especially useful. Active listening involves asking genuine, open-ended, non-leading questions, then listening quietly to the answer, and then repeating back what you heard so it's clear that you heard it correctly, as we discuss in the next chapter. It is especially critical in these moments to be careful not to twist your questions into accusations or statements of intent. "Why would you want to hurt me in this way?" is a manipulative, coercive statement, not an attempt at genuine communication. Even without disproportionate power, people manipulate one another in relationships in many subtle ways. People might seek agreement by shifting blame, appealing to a sense of fairness, or implying that the other person is negotiating in bad faith. Statements like, "Why do you have to have sex with someone else when you know how much that hurts me?" are a common tactic that shifts responsibility from one person's emotional state onto another person. Appealing to social norms is another way to try and coerce agreement. This tends to be more common in mono, poly relationships or with couples who are opening up than in relationships that are poly from the beginning. It includes statements like, "Why can't you just agree to normal relationships like other people?" Eve's former partner, Ray, once said he could not accompany Eve and Peter on a vacation because he wouldn't be able to explain to their parents and social circle why he was going somewhere without his wife. Still, another technique for manipulating agreement involves preying on fear of abandonment. Statements like, "What would you do without me?" or, "I don't know why I even stay here and let you do this to me," can be attempts to use emotional blackmail to compel agreement. Now that we've covered the ways communications in poly relationships can go wrong, what strategies can you use to help it go well? That's the subject of the next chapter. Questions to ask yourself. Communication in relationships, and polyamorous relationships in particular, can be like a proverbial minefield. As you attempt to negotiate this potentially dangerous territory, here are some questions to guide you. Do I use words the same way my partner does? Do I often find myself in discussion about the meaning of words? If I have a problem with someone's behavior, do I discuss the problem with that person? If my partners have a problem with someone else's behavior, do I encourage them to bring it up with that person? Do I communicate passively or directly? Do I look for hidden meanings in other people's words? Do I bury my real meaning? Do I communicate authentically in ways that make me vulnerable? In what ways do I actively listen to my partners? 7. Communication strategies. Attention is the rarest and purest form of generosity. Simone Weil. The best measure of the health of any relationship is the quality of the communication in it. Every single thing that we can't or won't talk about, openly and without fear of shame, is a crack in the relationship's foundation. Therefore, strategies for successful communication are some of the most important tools in your relationship toolkit. Polyamory challenges us to communicate to a degree that other relationship models don't. In monogamous couples, for instance, if we're attracted to a third person, we're usually expected to pretend we're not. In poly relationships, communicating what we're feeling, even at the risk of making our partners uncomfortable, is the only way to build multiple sustainable relationships. Polyamory doesn't give us the luxury of avoiding tough, uncomfortable subjects. A communication toolbox. Before we look at some helpful communication strategies, there's something we have to say. You are, almost certainly, a lousy communicator. How can we say that when we don't know you? Because 99% of the population, ourselves included, are lousy communicators. Most of us are exceptionally good at misunderstanding each other, misreading each other's tone and intent, and failing to get our point across. But usually, we don't realize it. Usually, we think we've communicated just fine, and it's the other person who has the problem. Passive and passive-aggressive communicators tend to believe they are direct communicators. And all of us, being humans, are exceptionally good at storytelling, making up tales to explain things we don't understand without even realizing it. Learning good communication skills is something we can't possibly cover thoroughly in this book. We'll cover only those communication issues most directly applicable to polyamory. We recommend, though, that you make a commitment to improving your communication skills on an ongoing basis if you're serious about success in polyamorous relationships long after you finish this book. Certain communication techniques should be in everyone's toolbox for any relationship. Each of the ones we'll discuss has many books dedicated to it, so we'll just briefly touch on them. You'll find great resources for developing these skills at the end of the paperback and digital versions of this book. 3 of these essential communication tools are active listening, direct communication, and non-violent communication. Active listening. When people think about communication, often their focus is on getting across what they want to say. But communication breaks down just as often, if not more often, in the listening as in the speaking. Active listening is a great technique, not just for effective communication, but for connecting with your partner, making sure they feel heard. Active listening is often taught in conflict resolution courses and couples counseling. As tough as it can be to practice, the mechanics of active listening are pretty simple. You listen intently to what the other person is saying, rather than using that time to think about the next thing you want to say. Then you repeat back to the other person what they have just said to you, in your own words, so that they know you understood. Then you trade roles. Because a need to be heard and understood is at the root of many interpersonal conflicts, active listening can go a long way towards diffusing intense situations, even when a solution is not yet apparent. Direct communication. This technique entails 2 things. Being direct in what you say, without subtext, hidden meaning, coded language, or tacit expectations, and assuming directness in what you hear, without looking for hidden meaning or buried messages. Good communication is not a treasure hunt or a game of Where's Waldo meaning. Being direct in your speech means saying plainly what you think and asking plainly for what you need. It requires identifying what you want, then clearly and simply asking for it, not dropping hints or talking around the need. You assume that your partner will take your words at face value, without searching for hidden intent. You convey your meaning in the words you use, not in side channels such as posture, tone, or body language. And you are willing to speak directly, even when it might be uncomfortable. In the previous chapter story about passing the sweeper, communication started going wrong because Franklin and Celeste were using words differently. But that wasn't all that happened. When the first layer of communication failed, that created a situation where Celeste made assumptions about Franklin's motivations, that he didn't want to help with the housework. That made her upset, and communication ran further off the rails. Direct listening starts from the premise that if your partner wants something, she will ask for it. You need to resist the impulse to infer a judgment, desire, or need that's not explicitly stated. You assume that if your partner does not bring up an issue, she has no issue. And she's not just being polite. Conversely, if she brings up an issue, she's not doing it to be confrontational or impolite, but to discuss it. You do not look for veiled intent, particularly veiled criticism, especially when talking about emotional or contentious matters. Because direct communication is an indispensable skill in poly relationships, we return to it in more depth later in this chapter. Non-violent communication, often called NVC. Non-violent communication involves separating observation from evaluation and judgment, and separating feelings and needs from strategies and actions. The speaker puts aside her assumptions about another's motivations and examines her own emotional responses. This is demanding cognitive work. It's surprisingly hard to do well, but when done right, it is an incredibly powerful tool for connection and conflict resolution. NVC is taught as a four-step process: observation, feeling, need, request. The observation must be made without judgment or assumptions, stating only what a camera would capture. For instance, you say, "When I saw you come into the room and sit across from me at the table," not, "When you came into the room, you wouldn't sit next to me." The feeling must focus on what you felt. For example, "I felt lonely," or "I felt afraid," not on what you think the other felt or intended, such as, "I felt that you were rejecting me." The need also must focus on you, not the other person. You might say, "I need to feel supported when I'm in a group of people I don't know," not, "I need you to sit next to me." The request is usually a request for communication. "Will you talk to me about how you can help me feel supported when we go to events together?" Non-violent communication is, sadly, often abused. It can paradoxically become a weapon if your motivation is to change another person rather than connect with them. If you want to explore non-violent communication, we strongly recommend that you take the time to learn it well. Start by picking up Marshall Rosenberg's book, Non-Violent Communication, and consider enrolling in a workshop, available in many cities. The world through our own lenses. Communication extends beyond words. Even when everyone agrees on the meaning of words, things can go wrong when we have different conceptual frameworks, different ideas about the way the world works. After all, we see the world through a lens of our own experiences and ideologies. When we communicate, we filter the things another person says through these frameworks. If someone holds what to us seems an alien idea or a worldview we don't understand, or speaks from experiences very different from ours, communication can be lost. This happened to Franklin at a jealousy workshop. Franklin: "Jealousy is an internal emotional state. A person who says, 'I am jealous,' is making a statement about an internal feeling. You can't necessarily draw any conclusions about that person's circumstance just from that statement." Audience member: "Hogwash. Jealousy is not caused by internal feelings. A person might feel jealous because of something somebody did. You're just trying to dodge responsibility for your actions, that's all." Franklin: "The idea that jealousy is an internal emotion doesn't say anything about the causes of jealousy." Audience member: "Yes, it does. You're just repeating that tired old line that jealousy is all in someone's head and that the person just needs to get over it already." We can't help but see the world through our own lenses, and it's not always obvious where our perceptions of the world diverge from other people's. A big part of being able to communicate with someone who seems to hold a different worldview or who has different experiences is to listen and ask clarifying questions. It's tempting to impose your own understanding on other people. "You're just saying jealousy is all in my head." And if we don't pay attention, we can end up doing this without being aware of it. Effective communication succeeds more often when we ask questions than when people tell other people what they're saying, or, God help us, tell them what they're thinking or feeling. In practice, it sounds to me like you're saying, "I have to get over jealousy by myself." Is that really what you're saying? Techniques for direct communication. There's a way through the distortions of our own personal lens. Direct communication. This skill does not come naturally to many, but it's one everyone can learn, and one that every polyamorous person must learn if they want to communicate effectively within their romantic networks. Many excellent resources exist for learning direct communication. Many universities and continuing studies departments offer workshops in direct communication, sometimes called assertiveness training. The books by Harriet Lerner, listed in the resources section of the paperback and digital versions of this book, offer good strategies for direct but compassionate communication. We urge you to explore this topic more if it's new to you. But we will touch briefly here on what direct communication is and why it's so important for poly relationships. The single most effective way to start communicating directly is to use declarative statements rather than leading questions. For example, say, I would like to go out tonight, rather than, would you like to go out tonight? Statements that begin with I want, I feel, and I need are all markers of direct communication. They do not require a decoder ring to interpret correctly. Plain language is another hallmark of direct communication. Make statements in active rather than passive voice. I broke the vase, rather than the vase got broken by my broom handle. Use simple declarations rather than complex sentences. I need you to take the garbage out rather than taking care of this problem with the garbage was supposed to be your responsibility. Use specific, concrete examples to illustrate what you're saying. Instead of saying, you don't pay attention to my needs, list examples of times when you feel your needs weren't met. Take responsibility for your desires, thoughts, and feelings. And if you're asked to do something you'd rather not, don't make excuses for not doing it. Rather, take ownership of it. I don't want to do that. Try not to place responsibility for your feelings on your partner. Instead of saying, you make me so angry, say, I feel angry. Give your partner the space to talk about her feelings as well. Avoid hyperbole. You always leave your socks on the coffee table. You never close the garage door. And inferences of motivation. You're only doing that because you want to get rid of me. You clearly don't respect me. Direct communication and active listening are complementary. Active listening means paying attention to what your partner is saying, rather than thinking of ways to refute what they're saying or interrupting. Direct communication is saying clearly what you want attention paid to. There is one other element of direct communication, the ability to say yes, and especially no, without reservation. We've mentioned this before, but it's worth repeating. The ability to say no is vital to consent. Without the ability to say no, a relationship becomes coercive. But there is another advantage to being able to say no. When you are accustomed to using passive communication or unable to set boundaries, or when you feel you don't have the ability to say no to something, then it's very hard for your partners to have confidence in your yes. If you say yes to everything, then your yes might or might not be sincere, and your partner ends up trying to read tea leaves to figure out if you mean it or not. If you don't want to do something, you may become resentful when you do it, even if you said yes to it. Conversely, when you are able to say no and your partner knows it, he knows your yes is genuine. Ask for what you need. Asking for what we need is hard, and it's hard to learn to make requests in ways that are really requests rather than demands, and are heard as such. But being able to ask for what you need, and in fact being good at asking, is pretty key to poly relationships, or any relationships. For one thing, there's the obvious yet somehow commonly overlooked fact that if you ask for what you need, you are more likely to get it. And then there's the fact that people who are getting their needs met will tend to be happier, and thus better and less needy partners. We sometimes think we're being too needy when we ask for things, but when our needs are not being met, they tend to feel bottomless to us, and therefore to the people around us. The simple act of formulating the request and deciding whom to ask and how forces you to get clear on what exactly you need. What's at the bottom of the emotions you're experiencing, and from whom and why. But perhaps most importantly, consistently asking for what you need means people can trust you to ask. They don't have to be second-guessing themselves, reading between the lines or worrying about you. They can simply enjoy being with you and discovering you, and trust they will know when you need something, because you will tell them. When you ask for what you need, you give a gift to the people you love. Few of us are taught how to ask for what we need. Often we're socialized not to ask for things because we're told that advocating for our needs is selfish. Sometimes we minimize them to conform to what we think is available. If we really want 3 cookies, we may think, well, 3 is a lot, and other people might want cookies too. I'd better only ask for 1. Then when someone else comes along and asks for 3, we end up thinking, wait a minute, how come he's getting so many cookies and I'm not? Asking for what we need rather than what we think might be available is kind to our partners because it communicates what we want authentically, as long as we're ready to hear a no. Asking for what we want isn't the same thing as pressuring someone. As long as the other person can say no and we can accept it. Some techniques that can help in asking for what you need. Ask for things in terms of I need thus and such rather than I need more than any of your partners get. When you state your needs as they stand and not with respect to what you believe other people want or have, your partners will find it easier to meet them. Leave room for your partner to choose how to meet your needs. I need to feel supported by you is nicely open-ended, and you can give examples of times when you have been supported or things that help you feel that way, and then let your partner choose how to do that. I need you to do things with me you never do with anyone else restricts your partner's options for responding. Remember that a need is not the same as a feeling. I need to know you'll spend time to help me feel valued when I feel threatened. Direct communication of a need is different from, I need to not feel threatened, so I need you to never date someone who makes me feel that way. Coercive communication. Be okay if the answer to your request is no. The difference between asking and demanding is what happens if the answer is no. If you're not okay with hearing no, then you are demanding. Point out to your partners when your needs are being met, just as you tell them when they aren't. When your partners know they're doing right, this reinforces the right thing. It's better still when you can provide examples of how your partners are meeting your needs. This is also an important part of practicing gratitude, discussed in Chapter 4. If you've been socialized to not ask for your needs,